Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Kyle Linton from Our Wave. So, can you tell me a little bit about the work of Our Wave?
Yeah, absolutely. So our organization was founded in 2019, formally. We got our 501c3 letter. And the original premise of what we wanted to create was an online space where survivors of sexual violence could go to connect with a community and find healing. We felt that survivors had access to social media platforms where they could share their stories and they could access resources, but those weren't always anonymous and weren't specifically catered to sort of healing and the sort of survivor journey. So we just, as a bunch of tech and business and research folks, said, hey, we'd like to create something that's a little different than what's out there. And so we created Our Wave and have been growing it ever since.
So in terms of surviving sexual abuse, I'd imagine there's a huge mental health impact, and social media, as a traditional form, wouldn't seem to do anything in terms of relief of that.
Yeah, I think that the Me Too movement has been an incredible movement to highlight these stories that were previously undiscovered, and really to, kind of blow open the statistics that we're all aware of. One in three women, one in five men, and obviously there's a lot of minority populations that are even more affected. And so, I think that the platforms that are out there are sort of a pedestal for survivors, but they're, filled with people who don't fully understand the space or not educated, can't comment on things. And so they can oftentimes become we see it with everything else, a place of disagreement and unhealthy discourse. And we wanted to create a place that was protected and secure and safe and had additional features that were built on top of it, specifically catered towards individuals who had experienced trauma and were sharing their stories and trying to find healing and connect with each other. So we just sort of, as technologists, wanted to add layers on top of social media to make it a better place to do that, and safe and secure, but also just leaning into sort of the hopeful side of how do we help people, find healing and connect with community, which are, in our opinion, the most important ways to sort of overcome these incredibly difficult life experiences.
So I'd imagine there's an increased risk for persons with disabilities to be the targets of such abuse.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we see, it's interesting to us because we see a variety of different populations, disproportionately affected by sexual violence, and it's hard to know exactly how much because, this oftentimes goes without being talked about. So we'll see military populations, we'll see, populations with disabilities, trans populations. There's a variety of different subgroups that are affected by sexual violence and sexual trauma differently. And by creating a place where, these stories could be tagged and talked about and where we can understand the nuances and differences in trauma between these different groups, you know, we really wanted to sort of be able to do that with, you know, the power of technology.
So in allowing people to own their own stories and share the truth about what happened, do you think there's any sort of mental health relief that comes with it, sort of gaining strength over it?
Oh, absolutely. I think that what we found through sort of research on our team, and I'm not as well first to talk about this as Dr. Laura Cinco on our team, who's a professor at Temple University, but really disclosure is oftentimes the first huge step for a survivor to be able to talk about these things and understand where they are in their healing progression and to figure out what resources are going to benefit them the most. And oftentimes sharing your story and finding community are really the two factors that really help facilitate and that process for a survivor who's experienced trauma.
Stories being shared out there might help to clear up some of the myths or misperceptions about survivorship.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, survivorship is so different for everyone. Everyone has a different story. Everyone has, you know, a different way of viewing their sort of survivor journey. And that's really been fascinating to us, to just see all the different stories that we've received from all the different populations and identities and everything else. But really, it is so different for everyone. But if we can create these little small communities of understanding between, you know, groups who do have similar experiences, and if we're able to, you know, work with survivors that are a little further along their healing journey and they're able to present resources that were beneficial to them, to other people, that identify similarly, I think that that's potentially hugely, you know, it's hugely impactful for the broader community of healing.
So, in the supports you've provided to these groups, is there any success moment that stands out for you?
Yeah, so I think every single day, we're pretty inspired by the stories we get. The way we designed our platform is when a survivor shares their story, you know, there's lots of privacy and security things that we take into account, but we also ask them to do two things, to share a message of hope or healing with another survivor if they would like to, and also to specify what healing means to them. And so what we really try to do with that, you know, with building in those features is frame this healing journey in a direction that's moving towards hope and trying to, you know, every survivor that's come to us has said, like, how do I use my story to help someone else? And so by channeling that sort of information from that survivor and contributing that back and sort of passing that along to another survivor who's experiencing something similar, we've seen, you know, really incredible progressions from the survivors that have come to us who have shared constant updates and said, oh, well, at first this was really raw and I shared this, and then I felt a little bit more comfortable talking about it, and then I went to a therapist, and then I connected with a community of other survivors, and then I gave back to other survivors. That's really the exciting progression that we see by building that community and facilitating that disclosure, in an anonymous and safe fashion.
So I'd imagine when it first starts out, it's more of a PTSD thing, more reliving it and learning to manage what's happened and using that as a way of sort of guiding others, saying you're not alone.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what it is, right? It's you know, shining light into the darkness and highlighting these things for the world and giving someone a voice to share where maybe they have never had that opportunity before. And everyone, you know, comes into it differently. Like, we have survivors that, you know, have never shared their story in 20 years and share on our platform because they feel like we've created a place that's safe and, you know, beneficial for them. And then we have people that submit stories to us within, you know, weeks or months of you know, a traumatic event happening. So we really see a spectrum, but facilitating all these different voices and, you know, giving everybody a chance to share when they feel comfortable, I think is really, like, it gives the user choice and autonomy over their healing journey and their ability to help other people.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yeah, no problem.
Thanks. In this segment of our show, Eva Fisher will be telling us about BDD. So, can you tell me a little bit about your work with BDD?
Certainly. I facilitate two support groups. One is a recovery from BDD support group for people who have BDD or who are suffering from symptoms of BDD, of body dysmorphic disorder. And then the second group is for therapists with body dysmorphic disorder, the therapists with BDD peer support group. And that's for clinicians who are also either have it or are struggling with symptoms of body dysmorphic disorder.
So for those who might not be as familiar with the condition, can you tell me about the typical impact of dysmorphic disorder?
Certainly. People with body dysmorphic disorder, or BDD, are obsessed with one or more perceived defects or flaws in their physical appearance that are either not observable or just appear slight to others. The condition also has repetitive behaviors associated with it, such as social comparison with others, mirror checking or mirror avoidance, seeking and getting cosmetic procedures, which can include cosmetic surgery as well as kind of dermatology procedures, taking excessive amounts of selfies, such as like hundreds of selfies on one's smartphone or with one's video camera, hiding flaws, which is called camouflaging, which can be with like makeup or hats or hands or just kind of turning one's face away from a person when speaking to them if they think that one side of their face looks worse than the other. Also what's called seeking reassurance. And though most of us might think of seeking reassurance as a positive thing, people with BDD tend to ask other people if their perceived flaw looks okay without actually kind of saying that they think it's a flaw, or they might just ask over and over again, do I look okay? And people who answer positively, mostly, you know, friends or family members, the person with BDD simply refuses to believe them, or they feel that they're lying to them because they're convinced that they're ugly or that they're actually flawed. So giving someone reassurance that they actually look okay can make that person respond kind of in an angry way or actually make them worse or simply trigger more reassurance-seeking behavior. So, and if it sounds a little bit like OCD or obsessive-compulsive behaviors, that's because BDD is considered an OCD-related disorder with similar characteristics and treatment options to OCD.
So, how do these groups that you're tied to go about reaching out to the affected community?
So, basically what I do is I have listings on a few different places. First of all, the International OCD Foundation has a website where they have multiple OCD support groups, and since BDD is related to OCD, they have a listing for two groups that are in the United States. So mine is one of two BDD peer support groups in the U.S., and I meet online, which is nice because I have people from all over the world as well as all over the country joining the peer support group. Then there's also a listing on a United Kingdom or UK-based site called the BDD Foundation, and they have a listing of a lot of support groups for BDD in the United Kingdom. Not as many online, but I'm also listed there as one of two US-based peer support groups for BDD. And I also have a Facebook page called Recovery from BDD, and that's also how people find out about the support group.
So, do you know offhand about how many people are affected by BDD?
The latest figures say about 1.7% to almost 3% of both men and women in the United States are impacted. And that could be similar for around the world as well. What's interesting about BDD is it affects men and women almost equally. So unlike an eating disorder, which tends to favor women more women, it's not to say that men don't have eating disorders, but more women tend to. Basically, people with BDD, it's similar to OCD in that it pretty much affects men and women equally.
So I'd imagine the impact of a condition like this doesn't just affect the person struggling with it, but also their friends, their family, those around them, those who they do ask for reassurance or who have to be there
struggle alongside them as they realize that that this isn't a flaw, this isn't something to be ashamed of.
Definitely, it can affect family members and friends in multiple ways. Reassurance seeking is certainly one of them. Some people don't seek reassurance at all. I never really sought reassurance when I had the disorder. I had it for about 20 years, and I recovered from it about 15 years ago, excuse me. So people with BDD tend to avoid social gatherings. The condition impacts their ability to have a successful relationship and marriage oftentimes. It can affect their ability to go to work, school, or even pursue a career that they desire. Parents with BDD may also feel unable to care for their children properly due to having the disorder. They may feel like they're a poor role model for their children, or simply that they may pass on their, either genetically or through, you know, watching their children, watching them, that they may pass on their issues to their children.
So, do you have any words of advice for those who might be struggling out there with BDD or unsure what to do, what steps to take?
Certainly. I always encourage people, because I did recover from body dysmorphic disorder, so I always like to give people hope that recovery is possible. There are two primary treatment options for people with body dysmorphic disorder. There is a lot more information on the International OCD Foundation website about treatment options and self-diagnostic tests. There's also much more information, as well as self-diagnostic tests, on the BDD Foundation website. I would say that cognitive behavioral therapy is now considered the gold standard for treatment of body dysmorphic disorder, although it is also used for OCD, but treatment for people with BDD is a little different than with people with OCD. And then also use of SSRIs, which are medications like Prozac and Zoloft, using their more commonly known names. And those are antidepressants that have been found to be very effective in treating people with BDD, because it is a brain, you know, chemical disorder. It's people with BDD. There's multiple causes and obviously multiple symptoms, but it's considered one of the causes is brain dysfunction, and people with BDD just don't see themselves accurately, and certainly they don't see themselves the way other people see them. Most people with BDD are considered fairly attractive by their family members and friends, and just objectively, but of course they see themselves as really disfigured or flawed or really ugly.
So, when you talk about recovery, it brings up a question I was wondering about. In your time providing support to those affected, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
Certainly. I think, of course, I run a peer support group. It's not a therapy group. I'm not a therapist. So, what really stands out to me, and I've had it since January, I started it during the pandemic in January of 2021, because at that point, like I said, there are so few peer support groups in the U.S. that I really wanted help, especially because I've recovered from it. Probably the best thing that I've seen is really people coming together from, as I said, all over the world, and really just realizing they're not alone with the disorder and are there to really support one another, give each other some peer support, encourage one another, and really just share symptoms. Because for many people, this may be one of the first times they've actually talked to or met anyone else with the disorder. And it's very reassuring for them in a positive way to really get to talk with other people so they feel less alone and they understand that other people are suffering the same way they are.
So, are there any myths or stereotypes concerning BDD you'd like to share?
Certainly. One common misconception that people with BDD have, and even family members and friends, is that people with BDD are vain. Sometimes they'll even say that they consider themselves to be vain because they're constantly obsessed with their appearance. However, people who are vain are obsessed with their appearance because they like the way they look and they think they look good. Whereas, of course, people with BDD are obsessed with their appearance because they feel that they look ugly or flawed.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this. But if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Certainly. Thank you.
Of course. Handy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
The Red Cross continues to work around the clock to respond to humanitarian need in Ukraine and surrounding countries. Canadians wishing to help are encouraged to donate to the Ukraine Humanitarian Crisis Appeal. Financial donations can be made online at redcross.ca, by calling 1-800-418-1111, or by texting Ukraine to 20222 to donate $10. More information at redcross.ca.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Eva Fisher told us a little bit about her experiences with BDD. And we heard from Kyle Linton about Our Wave. In this segment of our show, Karen Trollope Kumar will be telling us a little bit about Body Brave. So, can you tell me a little bit about Body Brave?
Yeah, Body Brave is a charitable organization located in Hamilton, Ontario. It was started 5 years ago by myself and my daughter. My daughter, Sonia, had a severe eating disorder over a number of years that nearly took her life. It was a terrifying experience for us. And after she recovered, and she has recovered fully, we decided to start an organization to support people while they're waiting for treatment. And when they have milder conditions. And so Body Brave has grown tremendously since then. Now we see about 1,500 people a year with eating disorders, and we have a number of clinicians on our staff, 4 family physicians, 2 dietitians, social worker. So we offer a variety of services, but there's really a need for it right now because since the pandemic, the prevalence of eating disorders has really skyrocketed.
So how do you go about reaching out to the affected community? Let people know that your services are available to them.
So we have an active social media presence. We have 42,000 followers on Instagram and Facebook. And so a lot of people who reach out to us actually find us on social media. So that's certainly a way that people can find us. If they just Google Body Brave, our website will pop up. You don't need a diagnosis to reach out to Body Brave Services. You don't need a referral from your family doctor. If any aspect of your relationship with food, weight, or body image is bothering you, then Body Brave can offer you some services.
So, in your work, do you ever encounter any myths or stereotypes concerning eating disorders?
Oh yeah, that's really common, Cameron, and many people don't realize that eating disorders are physical as well as mental illnesses. They're very serious. They are one of the most dangerous of all mental illnesses, and people often don't realize that. They think of it as just a lifestyle choice, you know, if you just eat properly, you'll be fine type of thing. But this is so not true. You know, eating disorders can get very, very serious. And the sooner people reach out for support, the better.
So, do you have any advice to share for those who might be struggling with the idea of, should I seek treatment, or is it just my desire to eat?
So, advice for people, if you're noticing that your relationship with food or your body is really troubling you, maybe you have been going repeatedly on diets and things are getting out of control, maybe your weight is dropping or your weight is rising way more than you want, any of these signs might indicate that it would be good to get some help. You know, people often think of individuals with eating disorders as being really, really thin. But actually, most people with eating disorders have a normal weight. But when you look into their lifestyle, you realize that they have got, they're following very rigid types of eating patterns. They may be vomiting after meals. They may be exercising for hours every day. So eating disorders appear in many different ways, many forms. A lot of people don't even realize what the problem is. They just know they're
really fixated on food and the body, and they feel like they can't break free. So those are the people that really need to get help and recognize what's going on.
So, your time with Body Brave, is there any success story that stands out for you?
Yeah, for sure. So many. We sometimes have people who follow our Instagram for a year or more and trying to understand, do I actually have a problem? And then they finally reach out. And people like that often do recover completely at Body Brave if they've got a mild eating disorder. There's still a lot of stigma out there. You know, people feel that this is their own fault, that they made a choice to do this to themselves. But it's really not true. You know, eating disorders are often fueled by anxiety. And that's, I think, why we see so much more during the pandemic. People are socially isolated. So many of the things they used to do to relieve anxiety are not possible. And so we've seen just a huge spike in the number of people reaching out to us.
So since the pandemic and people's desire to get out of these patterns, what steps have you taken and what services have you offered to combat the difficulties surrounding eating disorders that have come with the past couple of years?
So when people reach out to Body Brave, right away they get access to an app that we have that gives them all kinds of resources so they can learn about eating disorders. They can do self-assessments. They can listen to webinars just to get more knowledge about eating disorders, which is so important. Then if they want, they can get a clinical intake and then start accessing our groups. So we have a bunch of different groups to help people recover. And we also have a number of family doctors who do some individual one-on-one counseling. All our services are free or covered by OHIP.
So I'm imagining that the group support plays a huge role in combating the stigma. I mean, if you feel like you're the only one dealing with it, it can be a difficult journey to get started on, but you have people around you. I'm imagining that takes some of the edge off there.
You're absolutely right, Cameron. You know, one of the things that people say more than anything else is it's such a relief to be able to talk to other people who know what I'm going through. So group support for sure is really important. And often people learn a lot from other group members. And of course, all our groups are professionally facilitated. So we make sure that the facilitator offers tools and skills that can help people recover. But I think one of the real major power of the group is the support they get from each other.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
It is a sad truth, my friends. Both eating disorders and survived trauma tend to get this cloud stigma surrounding them in society. I don't understand why it is. We can have compassion for someone who moves a little differently or needs a little extra help to cross the street or to open a door, but we think it's okay to exclude those with something going on in the mind that they have no more control over than a physical condition. The fact is, these people are no less entitled to consideration, respect, and dignity in society. No matter where we come from, what our beliefs are, what we may have done, fact is, we're all subject to the same struggles in life. The need to have food, shelter, companionship, and yes, I would offer on some level even the need to feel like we belong. No matter what the condition is, keeping an open mind and an open heart, the first steps in building those bridges of understanding. It's not okay to create that impossible standard that says, we can exclude you based on this, and this, and this. Oh, look at that, we can exclude you for that too. Past a certain point, you create a wall nobody gets over. You find you don't even live up to your own representation, what the ideal should be. And it's not up to anyone to live up to anyone else's expectations of how a person should move, see, think, or hear. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.